The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
A very warm welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Lydia Elcoury.
And I'm Neil Roger. Welcome to The Parents Show. Thanks for joining us on a freezing cold night here in Hertfordshire.
It's icy out there, isn't it, Neil?
It's hot in this studio, though.
It is.
We're going to take a jumper off in a minute.
I think it's like a little sauna in here, actually, now. So we've got a great show lined up tonight.
We have.
Tell us who we're kicking off with, Neil.
So first of all, we've got Sian Wilson, who is a local occupational therapist. And Sian specialises with children with autism. So we're hearing a bit more about her work and how she helps those kids and what she gets up to. So I'm looking forward to chatting to Sian.
Yeah, and trying to understand what occupational therapy is. I have to say, it's relatively new to me.
Yeah, same. Absolutely the same. I confidently looked at Sian's occupational therapy thing. I thought, yeah, occupational therapist, I know what that is. I don't know what that is. So I've got a lot of questions for Sian.
Great stuff. And then later in the show, we've got a parent show favourite, Danielle Durrant from the Cobble Kitchen, is joining us to talk to us about how to get our kids cooking. Neil, do you cook with your son?
Not with my son. So my boy Freddie's 4 and things go in and out of fashion with him very quickly. So we don't cook together. Basically, I try and keep him away from the oven and just try and make stuff that he will actually eat, which ranges day to day. So not yet, one day. Hopefully, Danielle can give us a bit of a few tips on that.
Yeah, she is. It's early days. 4. Exactly. I'm the other end of the spectrum now where I'm hoping they're going to start cooking for me, you know. Really looking forward to speaking to Danielle in the second half of the show. So let's kick off by speaking to our first guest. We've got Sian Wilson live in the studio with us. Hi, Sian.
Hello.
Lovely to have you with us on The Parents Show.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
It's fabulous to have you here. And I full disclosure, I did confess I'm not 100% sure about occupational therapy. Can you tell us what it is and exactly what you do?
Okay, well, I help children with special needs. Occupation is all about everything you do all day, every day, anything, self-care, whether you eat, sleep, go to bed, get up, your job, everything. So I help children with special needs to be more independent in all of those different areas of life, really.
And Sian, are you doing this in schools?
I do this in school. I did start off in the NHS for, this was 30 years ago, in sort of community and mixed caseload, lots of different sorts of students, aged 0 to 18. And over the years, I did lots of different things. And when I had my daughter, I decided, to go into schools to sort of like work term time. And it's brilliant. Really, really good.
And what do you specialise in?
So I specialise in autism. And I've been doing that for about 20 years now in autism, other students as well. But now I work in a autism provision in a mainstream secondary school. So my whole caseload is teenagers with autism. So mostly boys. So that I've been doing that job particularly for nearly 10 years now. And previous to that, lots of other things as well. So yeah, it's really good. Yeah, love it.
And Sian, how did you get into occupational therapy? How did you know to choose to study it, to get into this line to this profession?
Well, what a brilliant question. When I was at school, I just had no idea what I wanted to do. I actually went into catering and did hotel catering when I was younger. And then I went travelling because I wasn't really fulfilled in that job. And I got a job as a nanny in America. And I worked with a family and one of the children had severe developmental delay. And I went to the local developmental centre with him and carried out all the exercises, got to know some of the therapists, got to know occupational therapy, and I just thought, that's it, that's what I really wanted to do. And I haven't looked back. It's just been absolutely brilliant, and I've loved every minute of it, and it's kind of my purpose and passion in life. So yeah, brought all my skills together.
That's so lovely to hear.
Loved it.
Sounds amazing. So obviously people know by now, I think, that autism is kind of famously like a spectrum. But, you know, when it comes to autism, what are some of the occupational needs that the kids have that you work with? And, you know, how do you support them?
Well, as I sort of, you know, if you sort of have a take a step back and think about what occupation actually is, it could be anything for the students on the autistic spectrum. One of the biggest areas is the social understanding and communication, routines, changes, managing changes. One of the biggest areas that I work in is more the sensory processing side, looking at the sensory areas of day-to-day life and how that affects you. It could be something really simple. You just mentioned about cooking, and there's a lady, you know, coming on obviously later about cooking, and that's my passion. So a student with autism recently said, oh, I'm not going to do cooking. I absolutely refused, and I just thought, oh, I'm going to problem solve this. What? Why? You know, is it a behaviour thing? Is it a sensory thing? Is it he doesn't understand what to do? Is it a transition? It's something a big, something new. So actually what it was something sensory. He didn't like he was very, very, very sensitive to smell and touch, and, you know, that was... So we supported him in strategies to help overcome that. So it could be sort of or any kind of difficulty that affects your day-to-day life. So, but particularly sensory and, you know, managing just sort of like routines and changes, focus, attention, and just things in school. It's, you know, actually getting things down on paper things can be marked, sort of like to demonstrate your understanding of and just sitting in the class and being able to listen to what the teacher has said. So, you know, lots and lots of different things. So those are the main things in the school. And it could just be very simply, you know, getting ready for school, making sure you've got enough sleep, you've had enough to eat, you've got ready. I just got on the bus, you know, got big problems, you know, often with just transport and managing that. So lots of different things, and then managing anxiety is huge, and sort of regulating your sort of like throughout the day.
So it could almost be anything, you know, like any challenge that they have.
Yeah.
You almost don't know what you're going to get on any given day, and then you try and help them find almost like a way of working through it.
Yeah, and it really, because I'm in a school, it's all about sort of developing their participation, engagement in learning, and getting the best out of that particular student for their learning, and just, you know, being in class, making friends, all of these. It could be anything, absolutely, but it's something meaningful to the student, and also, you know, because of the school, what do they actually need to do in their school? There's so many different things you can think of. You know, PE and a maths lesson are two very different things, so, you know, you've got to manage, you know, that really. So it could be anything. Yes, you're right.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the challenges. So what are the most common challenges children with autism have, or what kind of challenges do you see on a day-to-day basis? And then how do you help solve them? Do you solve them together with the children, with the parents, or together? How does it work very practically?
Well, on a very practical side, it's thinking about the student number one, and what is the challenge that they're specifically having. So identifying that, you know, what is the problem, And then you're very much working with teachers, other therapists, the whole of the school, really, in identifying some solutions. And obviously parents is it's a huge part, and liaising backwards and forwards with the between the school and home, what you can do at home, and trying to have that kind of 24-hour type of curriculum to manage life, really.
Wow.
So it could be it could be some day-to-day, it could be going into a class and observing, and then observing that behaviour, whatever, and then feeding back to the teachers, and just trying to find some sort of solution that's workable for everybody, obviously including the student, and actually bringing their interests and their motivations within that solution.
Fantastic. And you mentioned, I mean, Neil said it, there's pretty much your work touches on every aspect of a child's life, potentially. Is time management a bit of a trigger? Is that a difficult one to instill? What are the trickier things help with?
Time management is one area that we call it sort of like executive functioning, which is kind of like a very big topic, and it covers sort of time management and sort of like understanding the passage of time, organizing your time, understanding, because time is sort of like a bit of a concept, really, sort of like a number, but it's like you have to work out naturally sort of how long things take, etc. I think the other area is flexibility of your thoughts, your anything that's any changes. Imagine in a mainstream secondary, there are lots and lots of different things that happen, lots of changes, staff absences, so there can be all sorts of different triggers. So I think routines, that's it's huge, and just transitions from one class to another could be a massive. Just organising your work and producing your work.
And I mean, we deal with autism, and I mean, we touch on it in the parents' show on a regular basis because it's such an important issue for everybody in the school, not just for the children with autism, but for the wider community, for them to have an understanding of what the children in their class who have special needs, what their additional needs are, and how they can make it easier for their friends and kind of classmates. And do you deal with that as well? Do you touch on how to kind of raise awareness in the wider class, not just the children with special educational needs? Because I think that's also part of the problem, because I think quite often children with autism are left feeling a little bit left out of a class because they have different needs to the rest of the class, and helping the wider community understand that is so important.
Yes. So a lot of my work is very much raising awareness of autism and some of the perhaps the challenges that some students have, and always remembering that if you've met one person with autism, you've only met one person with autism. So every single student that you meet that has a diagnosis is completely different, and you have to sort of make people really understand that, and just sort of like think about that kind of neurotype, different diversity, and just sort of like think, individualize every single interaction you have with any autistic person, and just kind of like really support each person, and every situation is different as well. We have to remember that as well. So just being aware that you might be able to be very settled in one class, but in another class you might find it really, really difficult. And just awareness that things like unstructured times and break times can be really difficult as well. And just understanding what the diagnosis actually means in practice, and what you might see and what you might not see, and how you can, what you notice, and what comes to us perhaps naturally you know, just understanding people's perspectives and how that might be really difficult and a challenge for some of our students. So just being aware of that, and it's constant. Always constant, always training, always supporting. So that's one of the things, yeah. So
that's really interesting to hear you say that, Sean. And something I've been seeing your take on, right? So this will surprise you to look at me, but I was at school a few years ago now, right? I think awareness of this seems to be getting better, partly amongst schools themselves, but also amongst, like, I think kids are more aware of each other. So, you know, it sounds horrible now, but when I was at school, sometimes, you know, a kid might have been just known as a slightly odd kid. I think now their classmates understand the different nuances a bit more. Do you think that's right, or that's changing?
Yes, absolutely. I think what's absolutely amazing is some of our sixth formers have great mentoring skills and support. Some of the younger students that have just come into the school with a diagnosis of autism, and they've, you know, in the provision, they've got incredible skills, some of the young people, and just much more aware of and supportive of our students. Just neurodiversity is just such a big thing now anyway, and I think that, you know, there's so many different students that have got lots of different sort of like challenges, and we all understand that we all have challenges, and everyone understands that now a lot more. It's just much more open-minded now.
And do you think there's enough understanding out there of the valuable support that children can get from occupational therapy?
I think it's still limited, being in the profession for a long time. When I first started, it was very, very medicalised. You only really saw occupational therapists in hospitals, and it came out of war veterans kind of doing rehab, basket weaving and things like that. And so it was very much that type of profession, and now it's really broadened. People are much more aware of occupational therapy and what it can do for all different types of people. But having said that, in my day-to-day job, I do see students that could have had OT many, many, many years ago, and they didn't, for lots of different reasons. And you think, well, maybe there's still a lot of work to do on awareness, training, support for teachers, and absolutely parents and the students and young people themselves. Mm-hmm.
And is it quite school specific? So if there was a parent listening who thought this might be something maybe could be beneficial to my child, how might they go about finding out more about what's available?
Well, if your child, you sort of you thought, well, you know, maybe they could benefit from occupational therapy, I think the first thing you do is probably go to your GP, go to the local child developmental centre, perhaps have a look a little bit more online about what OTs do. We could do so many different things. It could just be from fine motor skills to sensory awareness. I would go to your GP first. So it's very, very broad. So it's not just students on the autistic spectrum. I've worked with very severe cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, all sorts of different students, people with head injuries, all sorts of things. So it could be, it's all about sort of like life skills and sort of like developing occupations in life. So very, very, very broad. So I go to your GP first. If the child is in school, then perhaps just ask your special needs coordinator in school what they think. They're probably would be observant, very much observant, or just ask the class teacher what they think if you're worried.
I can imagine, Sian, that when teachers see you coming into a classroom or into school, they must be so thrilled to have the support and the guidance that you can give them, because I mean, they teachers are overwhelmed. They have a lot of kids in the class, so it's hard for them to kind of adapt to the needs of every single child in the class. So it must be wonderful to work with teachers and help them get the most of the of all children in the class.
Absolutely. And it's sort of like thinking about, you know, specific students, and it, teachers are very, very under pressure. They've got such a lot to do. So it's trying to find a solution that's really, really simple and work. So they're not having more to do. It's actually trying to find a solution that gives them more time back and actually organising or planning for the whole class. And it could be something really simple, like just, you know, explaining the expected behaviour of the class, you know, some of the hidden rules that we, it could be something like that that's triggering a student. It could be sort of organising a timetable so that students know when the changes are going to happen. So in that in itself, managing those changes could actually, that would be good for all the students, but actually really beneficial for the autistic student themselves. So it's trying to find manageable solutions for everybody, and not giving more work, but less work.
To the teachers.
Yes.
Oh, brilliant.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I bet they have big smiles on their faces when they see
Absolutely.
You coming
so
into the school.
Yeah.
Brilliant. And listen, if there's, so we're coming to the end of our
okay.
chat this evening, and I just wonder if you've got any tips for parents who are out there. So you said the first port of call is get in touch with a GP.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think your child needs an occupational therapist for their special educational needs. What other tips would you give parents who are listening in who might be tempted to engage your help or the help of an occupational therapist?
I think the first thing you'd probably do is just sort of notice what your child is doing and what it is that is the problem, and you know, and what it is you really need to sort of address and change first, and really sort of like think about that, and you know, why you're needing that change or wanting that change. I think that's, you know, one of the first things. And there's so much support out there, and I'd just say reach out and you know, ask friends, family, you know, every person that I meet, you know, if I ask them for help, then absolutely people are really, really helpful. But I definitely get some professional help. Just a little bit of advice that's very, very specific to your child can go such a long way. So I would reach out to a professional.
Fantastic. Sian, it's been such a pleasure talking to you on the Parents Show this evening. Thanks a million for joining us.
Thank you so much, Sian. I've learned loads, and it sounds amazing what you're up to. So good for you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
So now we're going to take a little break, and we're going to come back in a few minutes with Danielle Durrant from The Cobbled Kitchen and all her inspirational ideas for getting our kids cooking so we don't have to cook. Welcome back to the Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Lydia El Khoury.
And I'm Neil Roger. Thank you very much for joining us.
That's it. And we thanks so much to our previous guest, Sian Wilson, who's a paediatric occupational therapist. And now I know what an occupational therapist does, Neil. Do you?
Well, I think I know more, definitely. It's, I mean, honestly, some people do such good, important work.
Yeah.
That it makes you feel bad. Like, you know, like, Sian is literally changing lives every day she goes to work. But yeah, she's amazing. Yeah, I mean, incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Nothing she can't do, basically.
I know.
But speaking of not being able to do absolutely everything, our next guest, I'm going to make you blush, Danielle. We're joined in the studio by Danielle Durrant.
Durrant.
I got it second time round from The Cobble Kitchen. How are you, Danielle?
I'm very well, thank you.
Lovely
nice to be
here. See you back in the studio. So we know what The Cobble Kitchen is, but our listeners might know what The Cobble Kitchen is. So will you tell us all about it?
Well, I can't believe it's been going for about 10 years now, actually. But, yeah, I left school teaching because it was just too much, really. But and felt inspired to help other mums cook daily, cook from scratch, because I was actually amazed at how many people just rely on ready meals and takeaways and things like that. So I thought, well, hang on, I was working full time, two boys, you know, my mum always fed us, it was just normal to me. So I thought, people are losing those skills. So I thought, right, combine my two passions together, teaching and food, and that's how it came to be.
Hey presto.
Yeah.
Okay, so Danielle, how important is learning to cook?
Actually, it's vital, literally, and that word means life, doesn't it? You know, we have to eat every day, but I think even more so now, we are living in a climate crisis, and what we eat has a direct and a huge impact on all of that, on the whole world. So even though you feel like you're in your own world, you know, trying to cope with your own needs and difficulties and time constraints, we still have to feed our families, you know, put something on the table in the evening. I think there's even more pressure on people nowadays. We're constantly being told what we should and shouldn't eat and all of that. Plus, we've got so many different types of cuisines. We've got every ingredient possible. And we've got our carnivorous husbands, not to be too stereotypical, you know, vegan teenagers and our fussy toddlers that we have to try and sort of cater for all within about an hour at the most. Yeah, it's tough. It's really tough. And I feel for people.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot to juggle. And so how do you go about introducing cooking to young people and children? Actually, what age range do you teach cooking to?
Well, I actually don't do any children's classes anymore. I did, and I said then just a minimum age of 6, but that was merely because of the size and dynamics of my kitchen. You know, could I really sort of manage any younger than that? But, you know, as a mum, I'd say just as soon as they can talk, as soon as they can move, really. I mean, if you look at cultures around the world, you know, you're all together and everybody sort of mucks in, and that's how you learn, by doing and observing and picking things up. And it doesn't have to be a formal lesson, you know. It's pass me this wooden spoon, or taste this for me, what do you think of that, what else can we find to chuck it in the dish or something.
That makes so much sense, doesn't it, instead of just making it into a massive big deal.
Yeah exactly.
Yeah, completely. And I think learning about food and cooking is one of those kind of, you can easily miss bits. So I remember, I'm embarrassed to say, within recent years, I've gone to reheat some rice.
Ah, the classic.
And somebody ran over and said, "Oh, you know, what are you doing?" And I was like, well, this is fine, right?
Yeah.
Apparently it's very dangerous, as I understand it. But then I thought, well, hang on, that should be more famous. So there's a lot of things that people miss. So, like, how do you sort of introduce it as part of, you know, a kind of day-to-day bit of thing that the family does?
I mean, the example you gave there about rice, I've come across so many people who are petrified, you know, literally scared of reheating rice.
Yep.
Holding chicken with their bare hands.
Fish, you know, is another one. I feel like fish is going to kill me one day.
The packet of the fish. Oh, that smell. Oh, it must be off. I'll chuck it in the bin. You think, oh my God, we have lost our sense of what is right, what is normal, you know. My mum grew up in a tropical country without fridges, had rice every day, and it is absolutely fine to reheat rice.
Oh, all thank God. I'd never heard that before, and I was just thinking, I reheat rice all
yes,
the time.
Yes, you do, exactly. And I think you saying you've missed something, actually, you've just caught up on a bandwagon that has really just run wild, rather than missed anything important. Like, of course you can. You just cool it properly, keep it in the fridge, reheat it so it's piping hot, microwave is the best way, and it's absolutely fine. As long as it looks and smells fine, it is fine.
There you go, breaking news. Breaking news here on the Parents Show.
Seriously, you learned it on radio, on the radio station in St. Albans, Mix 92.6. So, well, now we've learned something already, haven't we, Neil?
We have.
I seriously thought I must have been nearly killing my children because I've done that so many times.
They're still alive, aren't they?
They're still alive.
See, people don't look at the evidence in front of them.
Killed by rice poisoning. Yeah, no, I've never heard of it. So that's fair enough. But listen, so if we're talking about cooking classes, so you've taught a lot when you've taught kids. When you've been teaching kids, what have you learned from them that kind of has helped you get better in how to teach kids? Like, what have you seen and heard from them that's actually helped you?
Do you know what? Whatever you throw in front of them, they will do it. You know, if they're in that sort of situation and you say, here you go, have a go at this. You can use this knife. You can use a rocking sort of blade to chop herbs. You know, cool. How cool is that? You know, boys especially love doing knife skills and all of that sort of thing. So I don't think you should sort of dumb things down and pare it down to the most basic, simplest thing where you end up with something really quite plain and boring. It's got to be colourful. It's got to be really tasty. It's got to be cool. It's got to be, you know, something that's appealing on all levels, basically. And children will go with it.
Great advice.
Yeah. So what would the basics be? So you're starting tomorrow.
You still want the basics, don't you?
No, yeah. So ask him for a friend, right? So
but somebody the friend is a four-year-old called Freddie.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So somebody thinking of starting this, you know, in the new year, what are the basics that parents could be teaching their kids?
I don't know what you mean by basics.
Okay, So
I would tell them to chop some herbs.
Okay.
Get your fresh herbs into salads. Get them eating a whole range of different colours and textures.
Get them to even think about that.
Precisely.
Say, can you see colour in your food?
Yeah.
But what about holding a knife? I mean, is there an act to that? Is there a way to do it properly?
Yes.
How do we do it properly, Danielle? Tell us quickly. Here's another thing I've probably been doing wrong
You'll
for years.
You'll have to come to my lessons. Yes. Please do. Yeah, I mean, with children, obviously, you do have to be careful. But sometimes it's the short, stubby, blunt knives that you think are safest are actually more dangerous.
Right.
Because you're going to put more weight on that. And if that's on a slippery cucumber or something like that, it'll just slip off and you can do more damage than using a really sharp knife. But just warning them, just say, look, it's really sharp. And show them how sharp it is. And hold their hand. I mean, I've actually had my hand over a child's hand when holding a knife because they've not ever done it before. And so they don't know about their own strength, for example. So, yeah, be really hands-on and show and demonstrate. But I do think, I mean, I only learnt by doing. You know, I was always making things as a child, whether it's out of mud or fabrics or cardboard or even wood when I was older. So manipulating materials to end up as something that you want to look nice or whatever dimension it is, taste or 3D or whatever, you learn how to manipulate and use tools to get that end. So it's just the more you do it, the more you learn.
And is there something about getting them involved at the shopping bit? Do you know what I mean? So kids love a shop, right?
Mm.
So, you know, like kind of getting them to pick a potato out, getting them to realise what a fish looks like before it's cooked kind of thing.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Get them involved in the whole thing. Get them to bring it home with you, show them how it's
done. Exactly. So rather than sticking them in the trolley with a chocolate bar to try and keep them quiet or a mobile phone, even worse, you know, talk to them. Oh, what about this? Oh, have we ever seen this before? Should we try it? You know, be adventurous and involve them, on every level. And you can see the difference when you go around the supermarkets. Those parents that do talk to their children about about their shopping list and about what they're looking at, they're usually better behaved than those that are just told to be quiet while you get the job done.
Yeah, because they're engaged in the process. It makes sense, really. Yeah, I mean, it totally makes sense. But you mentioned right at the beginning, you mentioned the climate crisis. And I'm glad you mentioned that because it definitely has a role to play in deciding what to cook. So how do you, I have a couple of questions. How do you bulk things up? How do you make things go further? How do you make the most of what's in your cupboard?
Yeah. I do buy less meat, but I've got two, you know, older teen boys who are going to the gym and want to build up their protein and their muscles and stuff. So that's a bit of a constant battle. But all protein is good for you. Meat is absorbed quicker by the body and used for muscle development and everything. But, you know, you don't have to have meat. In fact, I always sort of explain, you know, how in prehistoric times, you know, you had to go hunting and gathering. And it in those times, that meant the meat, the most difficult thing to get, was the most expensive thing. You had to expend a lot of energy to get it. And now it is still a very expensive thing. So, but why do we think we have to have it every day? We have not evolved to have it every day. So I definitely buy less, hardly any. I will buy the yellow label meat, actually, because I think it's worse for meat to go into landfill because it lets out even more CO2 emissions than to take it home and freeze it that day or eat it that day. So there's two ways. Another thing is, you know, a family of four, if you're used to buying, I don't know, four chicken breasts, just get two and cut it down so they don't really notice. I've tried that. And bulk it out with lentils, with your chickpeas, with more sauce. And do you know what? It's the sauce and all the other stuff that is much more flavourful than the chunks of chicken. Chicken will taste like chicken, whatever you put it in. But what goes with it is where all the exciting things happen. So, yeah, I mean, this evening I made something up, actually. I cobbled something together. It was spiced pork stuffed aubergines, but actually it was about barely a quarter of a pack of minced pork, but lots of spices. I cooked some pearled spelt, actually, which has got that same sort of chewy bite to it as the mince. That with a load of all sorts of spices and aubergine and garlic and stuff. It was delicious, I have to say.
That does sound nice.
It's making me hungry, this.
Oh, no.
Well,
look at my Instagram tonight. You can see the photo.
What's your Instagram ID?
I think it's the Cobbled Kitchen, actually.
Okay, brilliant.
So, Danielle, imagine there's an idiot listening who somehow hasn't managed to be aware of what the yellow stickers on meat are.
Oh, right, okay.
And you're talking to an idiot who isn't quite... What exactly
you'll
is the yellow stickers on meat
know
about?
It straight away. You know, there's very often nowadays a section where they put stuff that has to be sold that day.
Oh,
or
I
else
see.
It goes
yeah, okay.
into landfill.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they reduce the price, and that's denoted by a yellow label.
Gotcha. Yeah, just seeing a picture of the latest creation. That looks absolutely amazing. Yeah.
Doesn't it look lovely?
Yeah, it really does.
So that looks like meat, doesn't it? I know we're on the radio, but yeah.
It does. So I'll just describe it for our listeners. There's half an aubergine with what looks like rice, but it's not rice.
Yeah,
what did you say? It is rice.
It's whole grain brown rice.
Yeah.
And it's stuffed with a little bit of pork mince, which has been cooked with pearled spelt, onions, garlic, ginger. Even I stuck in a tablespoon of tomato chili chutney. You know, anything in your larder, anything that gives flavour. What else? Gosh. Oh, the insides of the aubergine mushed in, because my son hates aubergine, but he can't see it, so he'll eat it.
Yeah. and then a lovely little
And then there's a salad there with chickpeas, feta, roasted butternut squash, cucumber, loads of parsley, lemon juice, olive oil, za'atar as well. That's a nice thing.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, I love a bit of za'atar.
Yeah.
It looks fantastic. I'm just showing it to everybody in the studio to make them hungry.
But I can really see the gap that the Cobble Kitchen is filling, because it's, you know, you see a picture of what we just said there,
mm-hmm.
and even to hear you talk about kind of, you know, feta and some of the different, it can seem quite, I don't know if intimidate is the right word, but it feels almost, it feels very difficult to imagine getting from what's in your cupboard
right
to that. So
okay,
is there kind of simple steps that people can break it down for themselves?
You go out to eat, I presume, in restaurants.
I do
every
I do.
Now and again.
Yeah.
Anything that you really like, what is it that you like about it? Or start to think about what are things that generally go together. So, you know, feta, butternut squash, chickpeas, you often see those in some form or another together, so you know that that's a good combination. And you just go with the herbs, the spices, the dressings of that area of the world. It'll go with it. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
I can see you signing up for a class.
I think I might do, but then not admit I've been at one.
Yeah, even
just
better.
Just suddenly whisk it out.
Just surprise
exactly. your wife. Come exactly. home and yeah. whisk up dinner. Yeah. So we had a little chat earlier in the week about coming on the show, and you said something really, really interesting, and I don't know the difference, but you mentioned burning versus caramelising. And all I want to say is, what?
Yeah, so I've got an interest here, because I've done a lot of burning.
Yeah.
I've not really caramelised too much.
Right, so. Okay. So burning, it goes literally black and you've got that smell of burnt whatever, you know, yeah. in the air that you have to switch the extractor fan on for. Caramelisation is a browning, and it will get darker and darker, but that is where you get the flavour. Is that, and we say it's caramelising, not just because of the colour, but it almost brings out the sugars in things, which sweeten and you know, even a savouriness to it as well. So that's where the flavour is. I mentioned that to you, Lydia, during the week, because I often have clients who just want to stir. Whatever you've put in the pan, you've just got to stand there and keep stirring, because that's what cooks do. You know, that's what they think. Anyway, yeah. So I said, hold on, just let it be. Let it catch. Think about where in the pan is hottest or not so hot. So move it to that area, you know, or if it is burning, rather than moving it away from that, shove it over onto that bit, you know, otherwise only burn more if it's not covered. Do you see what I mean? So it's that sort of instinctive, I'm trying to teach it, but yeah. I think if people analyse what they did more and would see what's happening, it's telling you what needs to happen next.
Do you think all the cooking shows help? So there's a 4 million on there.
Absolutely. So this is what I say. I am here to fill in the gaps in between the lines of recipe books and what no chefs will tell you.
Yeah.
You know, it's obvious there are more cookery books and television programmes around now than ever before. Every day almost. Also online, even my sons watch it on YouTube or whatever it is, you know, it's just like speeded up recipes. You think, God, but people aren't cooking anymore. So why is it? And I think it's because they see these amazing, you know, photoshopped and stylized images, and they think, oh, well, mine didn't turn out like that. I must be rubbish. And yes, I followed it to the letter.
Yeah.
But you and I could do, all of us in here, we could all follow exactly the same procedure in our own kitchens and come up with something totally different. And that's because the variables are almost infinite. Your pans are not the same. Your heat source is not the same. Whether you've stirred it for half an hour instead of just letting it catch. How you chopped your courgettes. Tell me, who here cuts their courgettes into discs?
Into
like wheels.
No, I usually...
Oh, good.
I usually...
Done. You do, don't you?
So it's a yes from Dave.
Well, I don't want to show off here. I'm discs and then quarters.
Okay. That's
how I'm living.
That's better. How about this? Quarter it lengthways, so half turn and then half again. And then angle your Ooh. Knife. That way, even your little quarter discs, they'll always lie flat, won't they, in a pan. And so when they're flat, they're just going to turn to mush. If they've got jaggedy edges or points and they're all random, they're going to catch the heat at their most exposed points. More flavour, more texture, they don't turn to mush. You see what I mean?
And it's part of it as well. Moving, this sounds a bit mad, but moving cooking from like the kind of job on a to-do list to something to enjoy, because it's kind of, I think a lot of people probably think, I haven't got the time to go for a whole recipe and get all this stuff together, but
and following recipes does take longer than not following them, definitely. And my thing is, I am actually quite a creative, hands-on, practical person. I like making anything, and cooking is the only chance I get to be creative now, so I definitely think it's my time to be mindful, to, you know, to take care of my own sort of well-being and forget about the fights, the nosebleeds, the phone ringing, whatever it is in the background, and just enjoy the most beautiful colours. You know, a red onion cut in half is just a joy. And then, you know, you're painting with colours and texture and flavour. And that is my time to be creative. Yeah.
And Danielle, are there things you always have in your fridge? Are there things where you just, you literally can't run out of? Great, you're nodding. Yes. What are they? Let me make a list while you're talking.
Lemons.
Oh.
Fresh herbs.
Okie doke.
Buy them in bunches and put them in water so you've always got them, because in a bag they don't last long. All your oils and vinegars. I love chutneys. I could eat chutneys and pickles out the jar personally.
But
I use anything like that in my cooking as well. Yeah, like tonight I put this tomato chili, just a Sainsbury's, can I say, chutney. And, you know, it's not much left at the bottom. Well, chuck it in your cooking, in a tomato sauce. Put it in there. Yeah.
So, do you always have garlic?
Yes.
Onions?
But do you know what? I don't always have fresh garlic because it does go off. It dries up quite quickly. But I always have frozen cubes of crushed garlic and ginger. And you get that in the sort of the world foods ethnic section in the freezer departments of most supermarkets. And it means I never have to waste time peeling, crushing garlic.
That is a painful job.
It is. And it's, you know, your fingers stick and everything. And if it's good enough for the Asian community who make amazing curries from scratch,
seriously,
it's certainly good enough for me.
Yeah, brilliant. Top tip. I have a feeling Dave does this.
No, you're, well, yeah,
but it's a tip.
And it's cheaper.
That's a great tip. And always have a selection of vegetables. Would you favour seasonal vegetables?
I should say yes.
Yeah.
but I tend to go, well, I think we all do this. You go with what you know your family will eat, plus one or two extras, you know, like pak choy occasionally, something. I think I eat most of them anyway, to be honest. But yeah, go with what you like first.
If you had to name one dish that people should maybe make a start on, what would be a good first one to have a go at? I mean, I feel like everyone can have a good crack on a bolognese. Like, is that a good
example? Interesting that you say that, because you're right. Everybody has their own bolognese way of making it, whether you call it a recipe or not. I think the most important thing that anybody needs to learn is how to cook your onions, because your onions tend to be the first layer, the first foundation of the whole dish. And if you're the sort of person that wants to brown your meat first and then chuck in the onions, I'm sorry, it's never going to turn out nice. Your onions have to be cooked really well, at least 10 minutes before you add anything else. But you season your onions, salt and pepper. That helps to draw out those oils, sugars, water, so they cook a bit quicker. But when they look amazing, like really stewed down, you know, not in water, but they're caramelised, then you add your meat. The meat's going to do what it's going to do. You can't change, you know, a pack of minced beef, but it's everything else that's going to make it really taste good. So yeah, get your bolognese right.
Gotcha. It's all about the onions.
And start with the onions, yes.
I have a feeling you probably aim higher when you're teaching your kid, when you're teaching young people to cook. What kind of dishes are you getting them to cook?
I used to have like themes for kids, because, you know, whether it was Halloween or Valentine's or summer picnics or whatever, so they sort of bought into that theme, and then we'd make a whole range of things that sort of fitted in, whether it was, you know, I don't know, making heart-shaped beetroots, I can't remember anything, or turning Frankfurt sausages into Wrigley worms and putting them in a nest, you know, which was a hollowed out bread roll, you know, that sort of thing, making it child friendly.
Very cute.
But yeah, they made mixed bean tuna salads, they made pumpkin soups and things like that.
Gorgeous.
They just made it look cute.
Very nice. Yeah. We've got just a couple of minutes, so I'm going to throw a total curveball. I'm giving you sweet potato, feta, chickpeas and spinach. What would you make? Can you make anything
with
that?
Sweet potato, chickpeas, What, feta and spinach?
Yeah.
Sweet potatoes, you could Hasselback them and bake them, roast them. So, you know, you slice but not all the way through. Toast, toss them in olive oil and whatever, some mixed spice, you know, you've got in your cupboard. Or some herbs and some garlic in between the slices. Put those in the oven while they're cooking. And they cook quite quick, actually. You want the skins all really nice and sort of gnarly and crispy. You could make a bit like what I did this evening, actually, a salad with your chickpeas, fresh baby spinach, feta, chuck in. Always have, oh, another thing to keep in your larder, have a jar of ready roasted red peppers because they're lovely. And you can just sort of chop those up, toss them all together, oil, vinegar or lemon juice, and that's it.
Did you expect her to do that, Neil?
No, I didn't. I thought it was just going to make a smoothie and heat it up. Sounds amazing. So that's what you can learn at the Cobble Kitchen.
Brilliant, Danielle. It's been fantastic talking to you. Thanks for all the tips. That was just really, really helpful.
Thank you so much, Danielle. I'm starving
now.
Okay.
I've got some leftovers at home.
Brilliant. So thanks so much for tuning in this evening. Thanks to Danielle from the Cobble Kitchen and to Shan Wilson, the occupational therapist. We're here again next week, aren't we? Aren't we, Neil?
Yep, we'll see you then. Thank you so much for listening, everybody.